This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture and it's Smira Sivasodhi. Over the past 10 years, women's numerical presence in positions of power and decision-making has received increased attention as growing numbers of women are standing for election into public decision-making positions. This has heightened the interest on ways and strategies to translate women's presence into critical actions and influence. Looking at the fate of women in decision-making positions over the next 5 years right here in Malaysia and having that discussion with them are Anne Ibrahim, the founder and CEO of Lead Women, Sundarian Berhad, together with Dr. Hamida Marikan, director of Harmony Works, and Zaina Anwar, director of Musawa, which is a global movement for equality and justice in the Muslim family. Welcome to the show, ladies. How are you today?
Very good.
Thank you.
All very excited that we are going forward the next 5 years.
Yep.
Very excited. Yes.
Excited indeed. Okay, Zaina, we're going to start with you. I mean, you're a prominent Malaysian NGO leader, an activist. I mean, you were head of Sisters in Islam for over 2 decades before you actually stepped down. How did you get into all of that? And, you know, what is really Musawa? Musawa is something that you just set up recently?
It's been around for... We launched it in 2009. It's really an outgrowth of the impact of Sisters' work at the global level because Sisters basically... is a groundbreaking women's rights group that work on the issue of women's rights within religion. And nobody else, I mean, it treaded where nobody else dared to go. And because even though Sisters is a Malaysian organization and only work at the local level, the work that it did caused ripples all over the world. And so there was a lot of interest, that women's groups in different parts of the world, had in our work because, you know, everywhere in the Muslim countries where women's groups have been working on issues of equality and justice for women in Muslim contexts, they face the challenge of the use of Islam by patriarchs in government, patriarchs, you know, non-state actors, Islamists, political Islamists, you know, who tell the women's rights activists that what you're asking for, equality and justice for Muslim women, is against Islam. And so we needed to challenge that, you know, how the use of Islam to discriminate against women, to justify patriarchy, to perpetuate patriarchy, how do you deal with that challenge of the use of religion? So that's how Sisters grew in that context and how the global impact of Sisters' work led to the launch of Musawa, which means equality in Arabic.
Okay, how successful do you think you were in the 2 decades?
Well, I think, I mean, the fact that Sisters, you know, is known not just nationally, globally, obviously there's resonance, to the work that we do, to the concepts that we're using, the language we're using. There's a lot of interest and impact. And it's interesting how now in the UN system, UN experts are now beginning to use the language that we use to basically deal with governments that use religion to justify why they cannot comply with international human rights standards and treaties that they have ratified, they have signed, but they enter reservations because they say this is against Islam.
Okay, you know, we just lost Margaret Thatcher, British Prime Minister. Now, I want your thoughts, Zaina. I mean, she was Thatcher hated feminism, and she didn't believe in women's rights. I mean,
I don't know why you bring up Margaret Thatcher, because women's rights activists, feminists don't believe in Margaret Thatcher and do not see her as a role model. I mean, she's terrible. She doesn't believe, I guess she's passed now, so she did not believe in women's rights. She didn't even believe in the idea of a community. She only believed in individuals. How could a person, even though she is the first woman prime minister of the Great Britain, you know, could be a role model for women's rights, could be expected to advance women's rights, when she just didn't believe, in the idea that women have been discriminated against. You know, there are many women like Margaret Thatcher who feel that just because she was able to get to the top on her own steam, she thinks so, that therefore other women could do it as well, you know, not recognizing the systemic discrimination and the cultural discrimination that women suffer for thousands of years, you know. Yep. And she just doesn't recognize that. And there are other, at closer to home, Rafida Aziz herself also doesn't believe in that. When we talked to her about introducing a quota system for women in political participation, she just didn't believe that, you know. Okay. She didn't want to do that.
All right, interesting. Okay, everybody wants to, you know, have a say in this. And and I'm sure you have a different perspective. But just to introduce, I mean, Anne, you've been, you've spent 20 years in the ICT industry. You've now moved on to lead lead women. You just want to tell us what Lead Women is about and what brought about that change in career.
Okay, yeah. I get this question many times, you know, why after so many years in technology and driving organizations like that, that I have now come to do to set up an organization like Lead Women. Our focus in Lead Women is very much in leadership and development for senior women, senior positions, for women in senior positions. And yeah, you know, everyone goes through phases in work, and initially it was all about driving business and in getting to the top of the organizations, which in many ways I've achieved, and I think it has been tough, but if we've managed to get there, and I enjoyed the ride there. And then after a while, you begin to ask yourself, so what next? And what is the purpose? You know, you want to find more meaning in what you do. And as I sat in a leadership position in a multinational, I began to get more aware of diversity and the value of diversity and how diversity actually drives organizations and brings a lot of business value if given an opportunity. And when we talk about diversity, it's not just gender, right? We were talking about generation, you're talking about culture, we're talking about all that drives value. So after some time sitting there, I also had a lot of young women come up to me and say, you know, how do you drive to get to positions like that? It's difficult. There are a lot of barriers. There's this glass ceiling we all so often talk about. And that got me thinking that, you know, maybe that's something I can do in the next phase of my career as I wind down and focus more on giving back after taking so much, you know. And that's what Lead Women came, and that's how it came about, really. So I wanted to do something that would support women in the corporate world.
Right.
All right. So I'm listening to my fellow women here, and I hear a lot of other aspects that can actually drive that. But I focused very much on corporate, and I realized there's so many barriers, so many obstacles that we don't see. At least when I was going through the corporate world and getting to where I wanted to go, I never for once thought about me being a woman.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you just drove. Right. And I must say I had good bosses who saw potential and gave me opportunities. And many of them were men. Right. So from that perspective, I'm not looking whether it's gender. I'm not really looking whether it's a woman or a man. But I'm saying give the best person the opportunity. From a performance and merit basis.
Okay. All right. Interesting. We'll come to Hamida. I mean, you've spent 20 years in the field of intercultural and diversity management. It's interesting, Hamida, when I read your CV, you said you coach and advise human resource managers on the development of underrepresented groups in the workplace, which includes women. And what have you found is, and human resource managers seem to be holding back when it comes to hiring women. What are some of the reasons?
They don't really hold back when it comes to hiring women at the entry level. The real challenge is once the women are in the pipeline, that's when we begin to see the stumbling blocks. Just like Ed alluded to, many obstacles then come in the way. And they can, you know, be range from structural to social cultural. So it's a huge range of challenges that one has to deal with in order to, you row yourself or, you know, really take your sailboat and sail through that pipeline. Because at every point, there are going to be obstacles. And HR managers have got to start relooking and redesigning their job portfolio as well. They're just not supposed to be the personnel, not delivering just the personnel function, but really working with senior leaders in the organization in designing policies that are relevant for today's workforce, which means, you know, you need to be able to have a really strong voice and help senior leaders see that if they don't make the shift in policies, they're going to lose 50% of the possible talent out there.
Okay. And what do you think your journey to the top, you were one of the few who sort of experienced a pretty, you know, easy flow to the top as opposed to a lot of other women. Otherwise, we all wouldn't be here discussing this today, isn't it?
No, I wouldn't say it was easy. I mean, first of all, I think it has to be work. You have to be able to deliver. That is a given, all right? And then it's about personality, attitude, your ability to network, communicate. And I think that part of it is where women really don't want to come out. You know, they really don't want to network. You got to make your connections. You know, and you got to be able to know who's out there who's going to support your growth. You got to find sponsors. You got to find mentors. You got to find people who can help you pave that way up. And again, I know I say I'm fortunate, or I did try very hard to reach out and make those networks happen. And those are the people who supported me in the growth to get there, you know. And just to add on to Dr. Hamida's point, I think one of the things to look at is not so much really the HR managers, I feel. The whole diversity strategy must be owned by the CEO, because it is a business strategy. To drive an organization with the right leadership teams and to get that value, we all agree diversity brings that value. Yeah. And the HR manager alone cannot push this change in thinking. And so that is why when I come from a diversity perspective and you want to focus on top positions, you've got to drive that change of thinking at the CEO level.
Okay. I was at a women's conference in France, and the most popular speaker at that conference was a man, and it was Carlos Ghosn. I don't know how you pronounce his name, the CEO of Renault and Nissan. Mm-hmm. And he talked about the importance of diversity in the corporate world. And he said in his experience, you know, when Nissan or Renault goes into a country, you know, making sure that you have in the top management people from that country and making sure that you have women in the top management makes a huge difference mm-hmm. to the success of the running of the country. So diversity is really, really important, and this includes women. And if the CEO doesn't agree with it, who is going to drive change? Because you're actually driving change, yeah. You know, to bring in those who are not included, those who are underrepresented into decision-making positions, you know. So I agree that, you know, getting the CEO committed to that policy of diversity is extremely important. And all the research shows where women, you know, all the data shows where women are in top positions, there's a difference in the profits the company make, in the success of the company, in the ability of the company, you know, or not just company, you know. Research done on women members of Congress in the US showed that women members of Congress are far more successful in driving legislation through, in getting more allocations for their constituencies, you know, in getting their voices heard. You know, so all the research is showing that women are very effective in decision-making positions and actually do better than men in many areas. Mm-hmm. So why this continued discrimination against women? I just don't understand the logic of it, because you're depriving yourself of 50% of the talent pool of the country in discriminating against women and not recognizing their talent.
Yeah. One of the other things when we come back we'll talk about is, you know, are men totally to be blamed? I mean, are there barriers within women itself, as well as, you know, talent corporation talking about brain drain and when it's happening right before our eyes on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. It is The Bigger Picture, and it's Mira Sivasudhi and Abraham, the founder and CEO of Lead Women, together with Dr. Hamida Marikan, director of Harmony Works, together with Zaina Anwar, director of Musawa, which is a global movement for equality and justice in the Muslim family. We're discussing women in decision-making positions and some of the challenges. I mean, before we left the break just now, Zaina, you spoke about, you know, why there's this discrimination amongst men, maybe, as to why women cannot actually progress as far as senior management positions are concerned. But don't you think, Hamida, that women have their own barriers to deal with when it comes to progressing in decision-making positions?
Yeah, but I think at this point, I'd like to make a distinction. When we talk, we are referring to corporate sector, and often we fall into this trap of referring to the corporate sector from the MNC perspective. So if you're coming from the MNC perspective, it's much easier for you to actually get CEOs aligned on this, because they see the value proposition, and it's a business strategy. It's a given. There's no two ways about it. However, when you look at the corporate sector in Malaysia, it's a different area altogether. It's a different arena that you're having to deal with. And here, women are having to deal with, you know, all boys club. Mm-hmm. All right, and without mentioning, you know, any particular.
You're so kind, Hamida.
Without mentioning any particular company, I think if we look around us, you know, even if we open the newspapers on a daily basis, and just look at the business section, and we look at all those photographs, you know, you see, you know, men in suits only. Where are the women? Is my question all the time. What happened to the Malaysian women? Right, so it's so we really need to be aware that, you know, there's a different challenge for corporate sector Malaysia, corporate sector MNCs, because MNCs have amazing policies that are driven from corporate HQ. which requires and mandates you. Whereas here, HQ is Malaysia. So Malaysia's definition of diversity...
Is there one?
Yeah, you know, so that's why I'm kind of pausing, you know. Is it about, you know, fusion food? Is it about, you know, fusion, you know, baju kurung with a cheongsam, you know? What is it, right? Really looking at the demographics, really looking at the workplace to see how it can benefit you. So if you look at the Malaysian corporate sector, the hierarchy, the patriarchy really drives... a lot of things and pushes women really out.
Yeah, I mean, I was looking at the data. The Ministry for Women actually produce an annual gender aggregated data. Yeah. And it's very interesting how actually Malaysian corporations do even worse than the government in terms of in terms of having women on the boards, women in decision making position. It's really disgraceful, you know. And again, you know, the whole issue of this very strong old boys network, very strong patriarchal masculine culture in the Malaysian corporate world, you know, so you can't just blame the women for not being socialized. Of course, women have not been socialized to assert themselves, to be at the forefront, to sell themselves in the way that boys are socialized to do so. But the fact is, we have a structural and cultural impediment, you know, that you know, where the corporate leadership in this country does not recognize women's talent and women's ability to move to the top and keeping it to the old boys network.
Mm-hmm. And would you agree with all of that? I mean, just going back to my question of, you know, whether we are our own barrier ourselves.
Sometimes I feel that that has a part to play, okay? But, you know, if you go take one step back, are we that much different in the percentage of women that are in top decision-making positions as compared to the US or compared to anywhere else? And we're not really. If you look at it from a board perspective, we're probably about 8% or 10%, some statistics show. And if you look at the US, they're only about 14%. And they've been pushing this agenda for a lot longer than us. So if you talk about cultural barriers and you talk about obstacles, they have the same. All right. It's just that the awareness needs to happen. And everywhere there's the boys club, everywhere. If you look at any board composition, there's always a 90% or 100% male sitting. So today with Malaysia's policy on the 30% that has come out, it's not really a policy. It's a target, actually, not even a quota. It's not mandated. It's not legislated. It's just a target that has been set by the government, which I think was a brave step forward and the right direction forward, because no focus, nothing gets done. No measurements, nothing gets done, right? So the 30% is a directive. And because of the 30%, I think a lot more awareness has been created in the Malaysian corporate context. And we've seen a lot more of the corporations actually opening up to it. But the proof is going to be when we actually see placements on the board, right?
A lot of corporate women would cringe at the thought of a quota. I mean, what's the reason for that, Zaina?
Well, look, any group that has historically been discriminated against, you know, affirmative action is justified. And affirmative action is not a perpetual policy instrument. It is a temporary policy instrument that you use to redress a historical injustice done to a particular group. So I am a strong believer in quota, because that's the only way change can take place. Because, you know, I mean, patriarchy is universal. It's not, you know, the exclusive hold of Malaysia or Asian countries or Muslims, you know. I mean, like Anne said, you know, even in the US, you know, trying to break that patriarchal tradition remains a huge challenge. You know, so really in many countries, you know, for example, women in political participation, out of the 33 countries in the world today, out of like, I don't know, 181 maybe, only 33 countries have at least 30% women in parliament. Out of that 33 countries, 27 have achieved it through a quota system, and most of them through legislated quota. Only, I think only 5 or 7 countries have achieved 30% women's representation without any form of quota system. You know, so it's really, really important, given the structural impediments and the cultural impediments to women reaching the top. It is really important, you know, that countries who want to use the talent pool that they have effectively to grow, you know, that some kind of quota needs to be introduced. And it's not enough to just introduce the quota. There has to be punishments if you don't, if you violate, if you don't have, you know, so there has to be an action plan, a time frame, and be serious about this. Because if you can get away by ignoring the quota, again, change is not going to take place.
So what you're saying is it should be legislated.
Yes,
right?
Yes, I do believe in that.
And you've been, you know, training a lot of these women, you know, to be placed on boards. I mean, how's it going so far?
So far, I mean, it's been going very well. And I think, you know, one of the issues that came about when they said, why are there not enough women, or why is it such a low percentage of women on boards? And one of the issues brought up was there's no pipeline. We can't find them, you know. But in this particular, in the case of the 30% that has come down quite hard, there has been a huge number of women who we feel are very much qualified to sit on boards have surfaced. So where have they been? Right? So I think this program is helping to drive that visibility, get these women in the pipeline. And the next thing is, now that they're there, and in fact they're being trained, and we ask ourselves, why do we need to train them?
Yeah.
Right? they're already qualified.
Yeah.
But the hope is that they are aware of what it is to sit on the board, the liabilities, the risks, and every board director anyway should go through corporate governance training every year because of changes in legislations and regulations. So these women are ready to go. So now it's a matter of, will the boards be open enough to take? And will the process of selection be more open in allowing for these women to be? So that has been the whole push from the Ministry of Women, which I think has been very positive. In the sense, it's not just looking at getting these women, training them, and now it's about placements. And I think they have also started to link with Pemandu to work on labs to try and work to see how we can actually strategize to get placements on boards. It's slowly opening up. It's been positive all the way from every aspect. Now it's a matter of changing mindsets, which is a long process.
Sure. Hamida, do you think the corporate woman is for a quota system like this? Or affirmative action? I mean, I'm going to go back to Margaret Thatcher, that Zaina, you know, absolutely doesn't want to hear of. Yeah. But she only had one woman in her cabinet in the 11 years that she served as a prime minister.
Missed opportunity. Missed opportunity. You know, she could have done so much more to make that change happen in that space, yeah? And hopefully others would have emulated, you know, her, you know, had she been aware of the impact that she could have made for women.
Yeah.
So
see, it's just not Margaret Thatcher. As Zaina said, Rafida Aziz as well wasn't for a quota system.
I will stay clear of that space.
No, but there's got to be a reason for this.
So the thing is, I think it's really important for, I mean, like Anne, you know, you've said to Anne, you know, it seemed to be, you know, an easy journey for Anne, you know, appears to be that way from the outside, you know. But actually, the women, we really have to work very hard to get to the top, to senior management positions. And besides there being a quota, the quota just enables the men to see, hang on, where are the women in this list? Why are the women? So you can ask those powerful questions. What happened to the women? You know, and the HR fraternity doesn't have much option but to then go and find, you know, because there are capable women. So somebody has been, you know, either deliberately not putting them in the list, and so they get, so they're missing from that list, yeah? So for me, quotas are a temporary measure, as Zaina alluded to earlier. You know, if we have been, you know, historically discriminated, you know, I do want to say perhaps, you know, unconsciously as well, all right? So we need to do something about it, and a quota has got to be time-bound. Any affirmative action must be time-bound. You can't just have it running, you know, forever and ever, and
I mean,
making excuses, you know?
We've seen how detrimental
and,
that
yes,
can
and
be.
Yes, and so what it requires you to do is, once there's a quota, with punitive measures, very important, because if your pocket doesn't get hit, you're probably not going to see a behavior change happening. So you need to ensure then that there are developmental programs in-house that enables women and provides them opportunities, gives them development opportunities, you know, on par with the men. right? Very frequently, I've heard it so many times when I was in the corporate sector, you know, oh, she just got married, you know, so I don't think somebody is deciding for her. And I go like, hello, have you even spoken to her? You know, who are you to make that decision for her? She made, that's her personal choice. She got married. It's a personal choice. She's going to have a baby. But in no way will that affect her performance. All right. So it's almost like it becomes a disability, you know, somewhere along the way, they see that as a disability. And I don't know where this is coming from. Yeah.
You know, talking about the old boys, Anne, I mean, are there, you know, training courses as part of this program to actually educate
change
these
mindsets.
Boys.
Yeah.
To change their mindset.
We should. That's exactly what the women keep saying. You know, what about the men? I mean, you know, we are ready to go right now. What about the men? They need to. So, but I just want to step one step back on the quota discussion, you know, and I think here it's surprising, but many of the corporate women themselves initially were up in arms to say, why do we need that? You know, because to them it felt that by pushing this, it's going to be, okay, we'll have a woman on board and it'll be a token woman, right? There'll be no inclusion in the diversity, but no inclusion.
Yeah, but that's an assumption that all the men are on board are, you know, qualified, capable men.
Yes.
Excuse me, exactly. Many of them are token men,
and
my
token
friend
men
from
well.
Form 5, you know.
Yeah.
It's like, honestly.
So, well said. I agree 100%, yep. You know. And so that's one of the things we said, you know, why quota? But then we said, nothing to do with merit. Okay, yep. Merit is a given.
Yeah.
So we are saying, if you don't have the diversity on board, then give the woman a chance. That's all, right? Yeah. Coming back to your question.
Should the old boys, you know, how do we change their mindset?
Yeah. So I think this is going to take a much longer process. Okay, and over time, as everything else happens, it will, but we can't wait for that long.
Yeah.
The time frame given is 2016, 30% women on boards. So there is a lot of work happening right now, from actually seeing and talking to various organizations, meeting up with GLCs, meeting up with corporations, and a lot of reports are coming out saying that diversity with women on boards make a huge difference to companies, whether it's direct or indirect. But the diversity of thinking alone, you can see value from it, right? So, Mira, there's no answer to how it's going to get done, but that must happen.
Right. Do you think it should be made legislation?
That will be you mean the 30%?
Yes.
Eventually, yes. We think that let the 5 years go by. We see some traction, but if you don't get to the numbers, I think there's a lot of agreement that it should be legislation.
Okay. It was interesting. When I read, I heard Oprah Winfrey's show with Sheryl Sandberg. Mm-hmm. She's the CEO of Facebook and an author of the book called Lean In. And this is what she said. I mean, if a woman is competent, she does not seem nice enough. And if a woman seems really nice, she's considered more nice than competent. Since people want to hire and promote those who are both competent and nice, this creates a huge stumbling block for the women. I mean, ladies, does everyone have to be nice and competent in your opinion? I know, Anne, you've done it. Did you have to be nice and competent?
You know what? Because there are so few women up there, what used to happen is the tendency is the woman becomes like a man in the way you run the company. You've got to be aggressive. If you're not aggressive, oh, she's weak. And if she's very aggressive, oh, she's bossy. So you never win in those roles, right? So the most important to me, and I think advice to women, is be an authentic leader, be yourself, because that's why you got positioned there.
Yep.
You know, it's because of your qualities, your values, your beliefs, your principles, you're there. So there's no need to be like anybody else, you know, and no need to consciously think, I got to be nice. Generally, women are very collaborative. We want to work with everybody. And today's leaders, it's all about collaboration. So we're in a great position to be there. So competence is given. And being nice, there's no such thing as being nice. You're being effective. You do things objectively. Yeah. You drive the company because you knew it's got to get results at the end of the day, right?
Mm-hmm. Okay. Zaina, do you think religion, you deal a lot with Islam, you know, do you think religion is actually a challenge when it comes to the woman, the Islamic woman or the Muslim woman in decision-making positions?
I mean, I don't think religion per se and certainly Islam per se is a challenge. I think the issue is how religion is understood, how religion is interpreted, how religion is used to justify patriarchy, to justify why women cannot be leaders. In fact, one of the phone calls I got in the early years of Sisters that really has stuck in my mind until now is a woman who's the head of a department, a government department. She has like over 30 men under her. And she called to say that, you know, while I agree with a lot of what Sisters in Islam is doing, I don't agree that women can be leaders in Islam. And then she said she's a leader, but she is holding this position reluctantly because it is against Islam to be a leader
over men. And then she justifies in her mind, but the reason why I have accepted this position is because, you know, I don't know what's happening to our men. Somehow there's no qualified men to take this position. So I'm taking this position temporarily on an emergency basis. She used the word darurat. Mm. And there is a concept in Islam. Ooh, right. In an emergency, during a darurat, what is haram, what is forbidden, is halal. All right. Yeah. You know, is halal. So she sees, she uses that logic of darurat to justify why it is okay. She's not being a bad Muslim in leading this department of men. Mm-hmm. And then she said, when a man emerges who has the capacity to be a leader, I want to step down. This is like, I just, you know, it's very distressing to hear this until today. Yes. You know, I feel like crying to hear that women are buying into this logic, you know, that or rather illogic, you know, that women cannot be leaders and just if, and then, and yet she did, obviously for economic reasons, she could not say no to that promotion. And so then she had to use the concept of emergency to justify why she's holding that position. You know, so I, you know, I don't know to what extent this is happening in the mindset of women, that all things being equal, the man is the head of the family, the man is the provider, the man is the protector. Therefore, it is better for her to give in and allow another man, you know, all things being equal, you know, allow the man, you know, instead of all things being equal, the woman should be given that promotion in order to redress a historical injustice. All things being equal, in the name of being a good Muslim, you know, that man should be given that promotion because he is the leader and the protector and the provider of the family.
Hamida, how
actually,
do you feel?
I mean, Zaina, you're talking about many years ago. It's actually happening even in today's, even with today's generation as well. You know, I have met so many young women in the corporate sector, especially those who are in developmental roles, who are being posted on assignments outside the home country, and who are reluctant to take those positions because the husband would then become the accompanying spouse. And so she will, you know, for the lack of a better term, you know, she's going to be the main breadwinner, you know, she's going to be wearing pants in the house, right? So and so she becomes, she will become the provider, which is not Islamic. So we have many women who are in that space as well. And partly also, you know, what's happening in the public space on religion, and there's this whole revival, and people are making those interpretations, and those are actually getting in the way of women also moving forward into senior position, especially for Muslim women. And I saw this right up front in my career, you know. And beyond just women, you know, if you have a boss who is a foreigner, who may have a different sexual orientation, you know, people are reluctant. There was people who are reluctant to take those assignments and said, this is against my religion. So it really does get in the way. But so you really have got to be working at that level and build that level of trust before you begin to see some of these things coming up.
Okay,
we begin to wonder.
Sure, we're going to the polls this Sunday, and there are, you know, a dismal number of women who are actually standing for elections. You know, it's frightening, honestly. And I think, as if we don't have enough policymakers, you know, in government, then how is this actually going to translate in a better way to the corporate sector? I mean, what are your thoughts?
I've been talking about this. I'm like, you know, we're just really insulted and angry with the political parties, you know, that this is 2013. And it just shows a total disrespect for women. So what is this idea of 30% women in decision-making position? So it doesn't extend to political participation because they're too much largesse, you know, and patronage for the men, the boys' network to benefit from, that we need to exclude the women from this. Because what is the reason for this? I mean, like Anne said, if you have a policy, you will find, you need to take steps to find the women. The women are there who are capable of being leaders, but they have not made any effort, and it's really insulting, you know, that the increase in numbers of women has been just been so minuscule from election to election, and for the MIC it actually went down. It's ridiculous. There's only one MIC woman who is standing for this election. And it's really, I mean, for me, it's really just an insult to women. You know, you the rhetoric, you know, you had the women, the Purple March in Putrajaya, yeah. A million women coming out, kononya, you know, the political leaders saying that, you know, women are, you know, they support women, women are great, women are this. Another march supported by the opposition political parties. And then, you know, to extol and celebrate women's contribution. And then where it matters, you just fail. You're just using and exploiting women for support. But where it matters, you just, you know, it's really, for me, it's just an insult to women. 10% women candidates out of hundreds, you know, it's just ridiculous.
Sure, that's just one side of the coin, Dinah. Mm. But what about the woman itself? MIC has got a drop in the number of women. Yeah. Anne and I are sitting here. Both of us have no intentions of going into politics. Yeah. And I would never step into politics. Yeah. That could be one of the reasons as well.
Yeah, it's partly true, but there are many other women. You know,
willing.
I mean, politics, yeah, there are many other women who are willing. And also, how do the political parties... You know, how do we develop a support system that make it easy for women to enter politics too, in terms of the money? And this, again, the old boys network. You know, we don't have the kind of money that these old boys have, you know, in terms of support for the children at home. We're expected to be leaders, but we're also expected to play our role as mothers, while the men don't have to change. You know, when your wife is working, you also need to help in the home. So all these changes, you know, a holistic change of mindset, change of roles and responsibilities, you know, need to take place. You know, I think the fact that, you know, the head of Wanita UMNO is not standing for elections, the head of MCA is Wanita MCA is not standing for election, the head of Pakatan Keadilan is not, the woman head of Keadilan is not standing for election. It really says something about the kinds of women that we have in the political parties and how they are treated by the men in these parties. I tell you, the women's wings of this party should be revolting. Mm. After this election, they really should revolt and start a revolution in the parties. You know?
When we come back.
To begin with, there shouldn't even be a wing. They should be in the mainstream. Why should they be the wing?
This little ghetto for women to play in, and it hasn't brought women anything.
Exactly.
You know?
When we come back, we'll find out if there is indeed, or will we ever achieve a truly equal, you know, world on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
You're listening to BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome back, Anne Abraham, founder and CEO of Lead Women, Dr. Hamida Marikan and Zaina Anwar. I love this discussion, honestly, and where it's going. I think I remember reading that there was, when we came up with the quota for 30% women in the boardroom, I remember also reading that we had a much higher percentage of women in government as opposed to the private sector at that time. But what does that say? I mean, does that mean anything to us, Hamida?
Well, you know, good job done. We've got the women up, promoted them, you know, hopefully with merit. They've reached the positions.
In government,
yeah. For me, while that is good news in one way, the real proof of the pudding is I want to see what is the succession plan. So when the woman moves on or when she retires, who's next in line? So that is a story that will tell. And I say the same thing even in the corporate sector too. You may have women up in senior management positions, but who's next? What does the succession plan looks like for the next level? You know, is the pipeline of women really there? Or is it going to be the next, you go down 3-4 levels, then only you see women between that first, second, third, succession is all men.
Yeah.
So the succession plans will tell a story. While we have a woman, yes, but what will the succession? That will tell how serious organizations, whether they're public or private sector, in really taking on this agenda of moving women up the corporate ladder with merit, performance-based.
Yeah. And your thoughts on government?
Yeah, I think, you know, I mean, they have achieved the 30%, but why not the most senior roles? I mean, we have seen some a number of women in the KSU positions, which is great. But you always find a very strong second level but never getting to the first levels. And we ask ourselves why. And that's also true in the corporate world. You always have the deputies and this next level below the CEO and the next level below the C-suite. Well, for sure, you know, we are the strength behind them, you know, with all the things that needs to get prepared. You know, you always have a successful man with many successful women supporting the organization. So it has to translate into something. And I think the focus right now with women in decision-making positions, at least for the corporate sector and also for the government, this is the time when the women who are in these positions need to stand up and make that difference. We have issues, okay? Women come into the pipeline, they fall out. So the whole support system still needs to get done. And that has to be done. Like it or not, that's one of the major causes why we don't see so many women moving to the top. So if the women today can take a stand and make those policy changes because they have the opportunity, if they can stand up and speak for making sure organizations set, you know, HR, if they are human resource directors, which I mean quite a few of them are women, why don't we change those policies in recruitment, change those policies in work hours, flexible, and we just talk about it, but we really don't know how to implement it. And so if this continues, it's never going to support the whole cycle of women coming through.
How do you think we'll be able to avoid this problem? You know, when you look at Norway, I mean, they've successfully legislated and they have about 40% non-executive women on boards right now. But many holding multiple directorship, right? That's one of the concerns with a quota like that. But it remains the case that they make up less than 10% of those who are running the business from day to day. Now, that is something we could fall into as well. I mean, are you not concerned about that, Zaina?
Well, I think first, you know, let's get that quota and get the action plan going. How do you achieve this? Get serious about it. And also establish a monitoring body to make sure that this happens. And if it doesn't happen, there must be punishment. I mean, like Norway introduced punishments. You get delisted if you don't achieve it. You know, and countries, you know, you know, there has to be a price to be paid for men's bad behavior. I mean, I feel that for as long as there isn't a price to be paid, whether it's a political price to be paid or a monetary price to be paid, behavior, men's behavior is not going to change in what is still a very patriarchal world that we live in. It's just only when they feel it in their pockets, for example, the issue of maintenance of children. You know, I mean, most men, whether they're Muslim, non-Muslim, white, black, they just don't pay child maintenance. It is only when, you know, in Canada, your driving license is not renewed, your business license is not renewed, your passport is not renewed if you don't pay child maintenance, if you have a back log of child maintenance, you know, then only they start paying. Suddenly they have money. Before that, they don't have money. When they're going to be sent to jail in Singapore, you get sent to jail if you don't pay child maintenance. Then suddenly at 4 o'clock before the court closes, all the men are lining up with cash and checks. You know, Your Honor, this is my backdated child maintenance, you know, because they don't want to go to jail. You know, so there has to be a price to be paid there. So these 30% policies must come with an action plan, must come with a time frame, and must come with punitive measures if whether it's the corporate, whether it's the companies or the political parties or the government departments, must come with a price to be paid for failure.
Okay, Sheryl Sandberg also said, and I found this terribly interesting because she said, a truly equal world would be one where women ran half our countries and companies and men ran half our homes. Now, is this in your minds, it is in my mind at least, the most significant stumbling block, Hamida, when it comes to women progressing in decision-making positions?
Yep, it definitely is. And I've seen it, you know. And so what do we do?
Yes.
So what do we do? I think really, you know, for me, the big one is we really need to go back and look at our school systems. What kind of messaging are we giving our children, both girls and boys? You know, are we, you know, sending them sexist messages in the school system, you know, where open a book and you will see a picture of a family. The father is reading newspaper, the mother is sweeping the floor, yeah, the daughter is doing some housework, and the boy is playing football. So what does that tell you? Yeah. All right.
But, you
so
know,
those messaging have got to change. And only then you will begin to see a shift happening where the boys or our young men will be proud to be stay-at-home dads, you know, and perhaps have a job that works out of home just like a woman does.
Mm-hmm. And not and all of them, not all of them. But, you know, as she said, you know, half,
I'm
at least
half,
run half the home.
Yeah, but I believe that's a lot to do also with us as women.
Exactly.
Too, you know?
Yeah. We're the mothers.
Because, because you see, you can talk about schools. They, they keep them for a certain number of hours, but a lot of the time they're also with us. And what is our... You know, we have two types of standards too. I mean, maybe not us, because we probably want to be a lot more open. But there are a lot of homes where the boys cannot do the dishes.
Sure.
And the girls do certain things, and the boys get more exposure and the girls don't. So that's also something that we need to think about. And I, a lot of the time, we are also barriers when it comes to growth in career. You know, if you look at issues in workplaces and political work environments, a lot of the time the women, because so few of them get to the top, they are quite reluctant to actually put their hand down on the corporate ladder and pull somebody else up with them, because the fact that, you know, it's competition for me. So I think we need to be fair on both sides. Yes, well, it's an all boys club and there's a lot of barriers and ceilings for us, but I think within us itself, given the time right now, there's a lot we can do, you know, and we need to ask ourselves.
I absolutely agree with Anne that upbringing is extremely important, and women mothers really need to change in the way they bring up boys and girls. You know, stop differentiating and stop reinforcing the gender roles. You know, why is it that the daughter has to help with the cooking and the cleaning and the boys can go out and play? It's just not fair. It's just not right. And you reinforce these gender stereotypes. Or where mothers have brought up their sons to be feminist, to help in the housework and all that. And then when the sons get married and they see their sons helping the wife with the cooking and the cleaning and they're not so happy about that, you know. So I think a lot has to change, and it really takes, you know, the whole society, you know, coming together to really believe that we're losing out by continuing to discriminate against women, that we're losing out as a society, as a company, as a country, you know, and it takes the whole, all of us to do this together.
Mm-hmm. Okay, we're going to conclude. Mm-hmm. We're running out of time. Zaina, where do you see us in 5 years' time?
Oh, God. I think if we can get 15%, you know, just I'm saying just 15%, you know, that is like a step forward. But I really expect in 5 years' time, I think the women's groups and the political parties should really push for a legislated quota. I want to see in 5 years' time a legislated, if things don't move in the way they should be moving, we should have a legislated minimum 30% quota in all politics, economics, you know, everywhere, minimum 30%.
Hamida?
I have the same wish. 5 years down the road, legislated policies that requires that quota right across the board. And I would say, you know, I'd like to see our Prime Minister take the first step, really, in making sure his cabinet has 30% women.
Yes.
One way or the other.
Absolutely agree
you
with
know?
That.
So if he sets that model and maintains that model... others will emulate. And the next will be the GLCs.
And well, I like to be an optimist and think that in 2016 we'll hit that 30%, because I think with all the work that's being done right now and the minds being open, I'd like to see that happen without legislation, but failing which, yes.
We will have to legislate. Thank you, ladies, for joining me today.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Anne Abraham, founder and CEO of Lead Women, Dr. Hamida Marikan, director of Harmony Works, and Zaina Anwar, director of Musawa, a global movement for equality and justice in the Muslim family on women in decision-making positions on The Bigger Picture BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.